Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Leve's fast rise to fame is a pandemic success story. During lockdown, the 24-year-old multi-instrumentalist built a substantial following on social media, where she was known as Jazz Girl. Since then, the Icelandic Chinese singer-songwriter has released two studio albums that blend classical, pop, and jazz perfectly. And while working in the style of artists like Ella Fitzgerald and Chet Baker may seem unlikely for a Gen Z artist, her music has proved to resonate deeply with young audiences. The first single from her most recent release, Bewitched, has been streamed over 20 million times globally since its release a couple months back. And the album itself was the largest jazz debut on Spotify ever. Leve's online performances first went viral in 2020 while she was attending Boston's prestigious Berklee College of Music. Raised in Iceland, Leve started playing cello and classical piano when she was just 4 years old. By 15, she was performing with the Icelandic Symphony Orchestra as a cello soloist. The Chinese side of her family has been studying classical music for generations. Leve's mom is a professional violinist, and her maternal grandfather taught violin at China's Central Conservatory of Music. And while Leve's classical training runs deep, perhaps the most surprising thing about her ascent to stardom is the fact that she's now known as a singer-songwriter as much as a musician. On today's episode, I talked to Leve about how she started singing jazz standards online and what inspired her to write her own songs as well. She also talks about the great sacrifices her Chinese family made during the Cultural Revolution when there was a strict ban on playing classical Western music. And she sings two original songs for us, including her single, From the Start. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Before we jump into my interview with Leve, let's hear her sing an acoustic rendition of her song, From the Start, live.
Don't you notice how I get quiet when there's no one else around? Me and you and awkward silence. Don't you dare look at me that way. I don't need reminders of how you don't feel the same. Oh, the burning pain. Listening to you harp about some new soulmate. She's so perfect, blah, blah, blah. Oh, how I wish you'll wake up one day. Run to me, confess your love. At least just let me say that when I talk to you, oh, Cupid, walks right through and shoots an arrow through my heart. And I sound like a loon, but don't you feel it to confess I've loved you from the start.
I love that "I sound like a loon" line. Such a great play on words.
It's a fun word, yeah.
In such little time, you've gotten so successful. I can confidently say that. I should mention, I mean, your album was like the highest debuting jazz album, dare I say, on Spotify, you know, if you just want to limit it to jazz.
It was like, so wild. It was very, I would have never expected that that could be the outcome for the kind of music that I make. You know, I really set out to just make the music that I loved and hope that people would listen. And the fact that they have is very, very special. I kind of can't believe it.
I might go all over the place just because you're a relatively new artist. I don't know a ton about you and your route to wherever,
this place now. Anything.
It's circuitous. It's like it's confusing, like where you mm-hmm. came from before LA and where you know, there's many stops.
I have
many
a lot
stops.
To say. So
how long have you been in LA now?
A little over 2 years.
And you came to LA from?
It's kind of confusing, but DC kind of.
Okay.
Because my parents lived in DC while I went to Berkeley. And then because
Berkeley.
Great
parents, so they moved to the States.
It just was coincidental, actually. But because my dad worked in DC, like between Iceland and DC. So
when my kids go to college, I'll also accidentally have some work to do
honestly,
nearby.
It was so nice. It was so nice because then what happened is COVID struck, right? So
yeah.
Instead of going back to Iceland, where I would have, you know, otherwise gone, I went to DC. So I stayed in the States and, you know, had employment authorization and stuff like that. So it was like actually quite integral to me being able to start this career during that time, I think.
So how much of Berkeley did you do remote, like from DC?
I mean, after I did 1.5 years in person and then the rest online.
Wow.
But I did graduate.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's no small.
It's a rare one. It's not considered very cool to graduate, but.
Wow. No, I know some cool people though that have graduated
really?
From Berkeley. Yeah.
Yeah. Some of us make it all
and look
the way
at you. you're setting a new tone for.
Yeah. You know, the standard is that if you dropped out, you made it. If you graduated, you won't make it.
I'm always curious about the Berkeley experience because it's such a unique school with such mm-hmm. a unique, very driven students, for one. You know what I mean? I feel like very, students who very much want to.
They want it.
They
very
want
much,
it. And they want it like not, you know, I feel like if you go to a traditional 4-year mm-hmm. institution where it's much more, where it's focused on academics.
Right.
There's a sense of like, you know, it might take a while to get into your profession. You might take a detour through graduate school even first or whatever, you know? And, you know, I know like with Berkeley kids, it's like, to your point, they want to make it before they even graduate. So that's an extreme amount of pressure.
It is. And I think, strangely, I didn't put that pressure on myself because I came from such an academic background. And my twin sister went to like a 4-year university in Scotland that was very much not like a music school. So I was almost on that path. I think I was different from a lot of the kids at Berkeley in that I came there quite open-minded and curious about what it was that I was able to do within the walls of Berkeley. Because I came in as a cellist, right? Like I was on a scholarship to play cello. I didn't go as a singer or a writer or anything like that. And I kind of was like, okay, I want to do a little bit of everything and see what I can do. And part of me just felt like it was so unrealistic to become a singer that I just didn't even, you know, dip too much into it.
So your track was cello, but you also want to pursue singing and writing, or you're curious about dabbling
absolutely.
In singing and writing?
I mean, I wanted to be a singer the most, but it just felt very unrealistic, which is funny.
Because it wasn't anything
I mean,
really?
Growing up in Iceland, it's not something you see that often. You know, you're not immersed in that and like, I don't know. I think I also liked to play it safe as a kid, right? And I didn't want to, I was a little bit scared of dreaming outside of the box, if you will. And I was like, who am I to think that I can do that? You know, I was also taught to like, I come from, my mother's Chinese and, you know, the Chinese kind of, my Chinese culture and background has definitely taught me like you have to manage expectations, stay humble, work very hard. Like those are the three kind of pillars.
manage expectations, stay humble, work really hard. Those are good ones.
Exactly. Like, obviously, like, strive for big things, but, like, in a very realistic way.
Yeah.
In a way that you work your way up to it, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas, like, I think the American dream is, like, a little bit more delusional, but in a really good way. Do you know what I mean? And now I've
Our whole country is based on delusion.
Exactly.
It's all delusional.
But I've tapped into that delusion now. But I think, you know, that's you know, I mean, in many ways, whether it be a good thing or a bad thing, I think that's why a lot of Americans succeed in really fantastic ways. Again, whether it be good or bad. Because
I think it's also why we, like, fail spectacularly, even after having succeeded spectacularly.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, big wins and big losses come from big risks. And Americans and American kids are taught to take big risks. I think a lot of not even my parents, I think I was just a very safe and calculated child, so I didn't dare to take big risks. But now I take really big risks.
That's great.
Even doubt.
What was your first encounter with American culture as a delusional?
I mean, I went to elementary school in the States from ages 6 to 9. That was, like, the first time I remember encountering American culture.
Do you remember how you felt before you got here, like being told you're going to come here and just sort of your feelings?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I was 5 years old, so I wasn't thinking too much about it. I think I was excited to get to move to a new country. I mean, I didn't speak English very well or at all. So I remember...
What did you speak?
Icelandic and Chinese.
And Chinese, okay.
I remember just how encouraged we were to speak up. Like, public speaking. There was an emphasis on that, even from, you know, age 6 in my, you know, public school in DC. It was a lot of, like, show and tell, sharing, you know, reading out loud, stuff like that, from a very early age that I didn't feel like there was as much of an emphasis on. And I think what resulted was, like, kids were quite open, and they were, which was great for me coming from a different country. Especially, I mean, I lived in Washington, D.C., and though it was, like, a public school, it was very international just because the nature of the neighborhood I lived in. Uh-huh. There were a lot of, like, children who had parents who worked in, you know, international service.
Yeah.
So because these kids were very international and because they were very outspoken, I think they accepted kids quite easily. So that was actually really good. But I remember just always thinking, you know, Americans and American culture was quite extroverted compared to a more introverted Icelandic culture. And I knew that from a very young age.
It seems like you enjoyed it. Was it uncomfortable to start?
No, not at all. And I think, you know, 6 to 9, which is the time that I lived in America as a kid, there's such formative years.
Mm-hmm.
And they taught me to become very expressive. And I think when I took that expression, like that expressive nature back to Iceland when I was like 8 or 9 in the middle of the recession in 2008, I felt quite loud. I quite felt really larger than life, like really big. And that was kind of something that I dealt with for a while in Iceland.
What about at home? Was it encouraged at home to be sort of living out loud?
Yeah, absolutely. My parents were super, super encouraging of me being an artist as well. Like, they, from a very young age. But I had a very disciplined childhood, not in a bad way, but in that, you know, I knew I came home from school and I practiced. I was, you know, treading a pre-professional classical music path.
And that's because your mom...
My mom is a classical violinist, yeah. So from age 4, I started playing classical piano and cello, and it just kind of became a part of life, just as going to elementary school becomes a part of your life. You know, you go to math, you go to English, you go to science, you come home, you have an hour of piano, hour of cello.
An hour of piano, hour of cello before even an hour of homework?
Yes, before homework. Yeah. But in Iceland, there isn't much homework.
That's nice.
Very nice. Yeah.
I wish that
Icelandic,
were the case here.
Yeah. You know, I would say that the nature of schooling in Iceland is a lot more relaxed.
Mm.
And, you know, there's no private school. Everyone goes to the public schools. There's no, you know, the kind of hierarchy of schools that has been set up in the States that, you know, follows you all the way down to college, you know, like people thinking about how they can set themselves up to get to a good university from the age of like 6 or 7. That mentality just doesn't really exist in Iceland.
Is there a big class dichotomy there? Like,
No, I would say, I mean, of course, like everywhere, you know, there's, but the wealth gap in Iceland is generally, compared to other countries, quite small.
Wow.
And it's a social democratic country, and it's, you know, follows the kind of Scandinavian principles, and, you know, you have free healthcare and education or very, very low cost, which is, you know, nice.
It's great that you got to bounce between.
Yeah, I've definitely experienced both. And you know, I spent every summer in China as well growing up. So, wow. So I
should
have
be another extreme.
Yes,
on
yeah,
that
I
sort
was
of.
Actually, I was in China just a couple of days ago. I was there for 10 days playing a bit, but it was my first time back since COVID. And it was nice to revisit that as the adult that I've become since.
How was it? What was that? And do you still have family there?
Yes, my grandmother lives there. She's a professor, was a professor at the Central Conservatory of Music in Beijing. And my grandfather was as well, who's now passed. So the classical music roots run quite deep. But yeah, she was there and I played with a China Philharmonic in Beijing. And I think it was very special for her to see that. And actually, my grandfather was a violin professor and a lot of his students were in the orchestra. And it was a fun full circle moment.
When did your grandfather pass?
2009, so
you were young. You were
quite a while ago.
Yeah, quite young. Yeah. Did you get to talk to his former students about him at all?
Yes, absolutely. And I remember him very vividly. He was like a larger than life person. I've actually been told that I resemble him in many ways, which is, you know, such an honor. And, you know, he really loved music so much. And he loved jazz music as well and loved like musical theater. So I kind of, you know, his idea of music was... It was just such a musical thing, right? You know, I feel like you can split music into two kind of things. In my head, at least, it's like you have the technique and you have the musicality. Mm. If you have both, you're stellar.
Yeah.
I definitely lean musical. Like, I mean, I've definitely, you know, worked up a foundation of technique, but I was never that good at practicing. And I definitely leaned in onto the fact that onto the musicality.
That you had like an ear. And
that,
you could,
yeah, that had the
and
ear
a feel for
and
things.
Feel for things. Exactly. Kind of the stuff that you don't need to practice as much, you know, to a literal metronome. But
that was always my failing. I hated practicing to a metronome. And so I was always told my timing sucked.
Oh my God. To this day, the sound of a metronome like triggers me. Like I get like a physical reaction to a metronome, which is great now because, you know, I sing to click sometimes, which I didn't even know was a thing until 2 years ago, maybe when I started working in music. It like bewildered me so much that like on stage there would be like a constant metronome in my ear. It's funny.
Do you do it in studio too when you're recording?
Rarely, sometimes. Okay. But I always try without click before I do it with click.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah, if it triggers you that much.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I've earned it that I can kind of just let the music live. But yeah, of course, sometimes I need to be, you know, pushed into place by a click.
Yeah, sure enough.
We have to take a quick break, and then we'll come back with more of my interview with Leve.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
We're back with more from Leve.
Now, certainly mid-century Russia, for instance, would have, and Cuba, rock and roll would have been outlawed. I don't know if jazz was the same, but it certainly would have been hard to get a hold of jazz records and things, I'd imagine, right? Like it'd be,
oh,
have
my
to be
goodness.
An import.
Yeah, and I mean, well, in the 60s and 70s in China, you know, there was a cultural revolution.
Right.
So Mao and the Communist Party, they basically, you know, outlawed any type of foreign influence and Western influence. And there was just kind of like a grand scale focus on all things just Chinese, like looking within. So my grandparents, who were professors at the Central Conservatory of Western classical music, that was considered, you know, the bourgeoisie. So they actually went to re-education camp and lived in the countryside for a while and were like rice farmers and whatnot. And my mom grew up in a boarding school because of that. And they couldn't play any Western classical music, no Western music at all. And it goes so far. I've heard the craziest stories from that time, but yeah, my mother kind of grew up in that world, and my grandparents also went through that. I mean, my mother, even like down to the clothes that you wore, you couldn't wear bell bottom jeans or anything, which was, you know, in style at that time in the Western world. My grandmother naturally has curly hair, which is very, very rare in China. And the communists thought that she had permed her hair, which was, you know, Western influence. Yeah. So she had to put her hair up in a silk scarf every day for years.
Wow.
Really wild. And none of them played music for the longest time, or at least the classical music that they were trained in.
How did your mom end up back playing?
Well, I mean, she played violin. She just couldn't play, you know, it had to be Chinese music.
Got it.
I think, you know, my mother was just so in that world that she, you know, that was the only path she could tread. And I think that's why my mother so emphasized kind of me and my sister's freedom to do whatever we wanted and become whatever kind of artist we wanted. And
because it was sort of so...
Because it was so strict as she was growing up and she didn't really have that freedom of choice. And so... She just kind of let us do whatever we want. And
I like that an hour of practice immediately after school is much more lenient than whatever she encountered.
Yes. Oh my God, definitely. I mean, the way that I'm so thankful for that because I'm still running off of that technique.
Do you still
to
practice?
This day. No, not nearly as much as I did as a kid. But, you know, the hard work that I put in as a kid is still paying off today because when I'm like on strenuous touring schedules or recording for hours on end, you know, the stamina that I've gotten from all of those years of practicing and kind of the focus that I've gotten, those skills still are lasting me at this age, which is really, really great. But, you know, I think that's another reason I really love the fact that I live in a time where I can mix so many genres together.
Yeah.
You know, like they couldn't do anything of the sort. And I'm just like, oh, I'm going to mix jazz and pop and classical together and present it however I want. And the fact that we have that freedom now is wild. I mean, it wasn't so long ago that my grandparents and my mother couldn't play even classical music.
I am so glad that you're doing it too. You know, it feels like we go back to in American culture and Western culture, we do go back a lot, but I feel like an era we haven't revisited in a long time is sort of that mid-century jazz,
right.
You know, like that musical world that existed then. And it's so ripe for reimagining because it's so expressive,
it's
so emotional, and so musically sound. And even the opening of your record, that sounds both like modern production and like old production simultaneously. And I think that's kind of like the brilliance of certain people your age, some of your cohorts, I guess we would say, who are sort of doing that, you know, mixing these things up.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, that's definitely the goal, to kind of hark back to that time. And I think that's the music I've just always loved so much. And when I started singing, I immediately started singing jazz standards, and like Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday and Chet Baker were, and then also on top of that, like the songs from Golden Age films were the only music I really listened to. Like, there's no other music I could make. Like, that's the music I wanted to make so much that, you know, whether it worked out or not, I was going to continue doing it, you know? But I also did find there was, especially when I started out and I was just posting like little videos of me singing jazz standards online, I found that there was such a gap for this generation. No one was really doing it, but nobody seemed to really dislike the music that much. Like, it's the bones of the music is so good, right? These jazz standards, there's just good songs that have lasted for so long and have been, honestly, like have been sampled so many times. And jazz is kind of like the root of all modern music, right? It's something that is so prevalent in pop music and hip hop and R&B. So actually, like,
down to, and to your point of it being the backbone, because I think most people think of like the blues as being the backbone, but really coming out of the big band era, like bebop groups taking it down to like the bare essentials of, it might be a trio, it might be a quartet. I mean, that's rock and roll. It's like three or four 100%. Or five people.
It's all connected. And so I think, you know, I tend to think the Gen Z ear is actually really trained well for jazz music. And we've been like subconsciously fed it for many, many years. So I also think that the timing of music now is like this new audience of music listeners. They don't really care what the music, you know, what era it resembles. If anything, if it resembles another era, like you're hearing these huge resurgences in like 90s rock sound, punk rock, honestly, like every 70s music, like Fleetwood Mac had a big moment on TikTok
pandemic,
recently,
right?
During the exactly. It's like all music is coming back. I think what Gen Z cares about is connecting to the artist, connecting to the lyrics, connecting to the story.
Yeah.
And jazz is really good storytelling, I think.
It's really good storytelling.
So yeah, it's fun that we live in a time where we can mix so many genres together and kind of make it our own.
How did it come to be that standards ended up being the first thing that you were singing? Like, did you encounter them through film or through some radio station in Iceland?
No, well, my father loved jazz music, so he played a lot of jazz music in the house. And, you know, as a kid, I listened to pretty much only classical music. And then I really liked, you know, obviously, like the other kids of that time when I was like 7 or 8, I loved like Taylor Swift and Miley Cyrus and whatever. But I couldn't hear any of myself in those singers. I've always had quite a deep voice. And when I started singing, I just immediately started, I think the first song I remember like learning and like performing at a singing show was Singing in the Rain.
Cool.
So, and then I just naturally, you know, I just listened to so much Ella Fitzgerald. I just kind of like, you know, started singing all the songs that she had in our repertoire, which kind of ended up being just the Great American Songbook.
Ella, talk about the sort of the spectrum of technique and feel.
Yeah, and I mean, like, she has it all.
Talk about having both in spades. Like,
exactly.
Who has both of those things?
Well, that's what I mean. When you're stellar, and she is the epitome of that.
Yeah, it's like few people, like her, Stevie Wonder's another, who
exactly.
I think you hear it less, but with Ella, it's more obvious that she has the technique.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah. It's true musicianship, and I think coming from a classical music background, I recognize that within her performing. And And also just growing up a cellist, like, she sounds like a cello. She sings like a cello.
In what way?
her voice, like the timbre of it and the vibrato, the approach, the legato, it's very cellistic.
Interesting. I'm gonna have to listen for that.
Yeah. It's like so obvious once you think about it.
I've been on an Ella kick recently.
And really?
Just trying. Yeah, just because she's so good. And I haven't listened in a while. And honestly, we named my youngest daughter, we named her after Ella Fitzgerald.
Really?
And her Ella. And she's just starting to get into music. So
Oh my God.
I say just randomly, but it's probably because I'm trying to like subconsciously get her into like, you know, because she's messing around the piano and singing and stuff. So I'm like, I'm hoping she goes that direction. But yeah, just, you know, I'm not a great pianist by any measure, but I love just messing around. And it's like, you can learn a lot about it.
All I do is mess around. So much. You can learn so much by messing around. I mean, nothing I do within the jazz world, aside from the singing portion, but I came from a classical piano background, right? So I was conditioned to do what the page told me to do, what the music told me to do. And then when I started singing jazz and I wanted to accompany myself, I started just like slowly learning the chords. And I'm by no means a jazz pianist. So like what I do is not maybe based in the most of technique. It's more based on feel, which took me a really long time to kind of allow myself to do. Like I think in my first recordings, I was like a little bit embarrassed to play because I was like, I'm not a jazz pianist. Like, but when the first jazz pianists came about, they weren't jazz pianists either. They were just messing around as well. So.
They were. And so many of the greats who even became like great in terms of technique and are revered for technique, they came from playing other styles, you know?
Exactly.
And just by circumstance that they had to record in jazz or play with a jazz group or something. And
exactly.
Then they picked it up and learned it over.
Well, that's how, I was reading a Bill Evans biography the other day, actually. And like he started out as a classical pianist and then just like kind of started noodling his way in and learning about it. And I was very inspired. I was like, I should do that. But I'm a huge Bill Evans fan. And it made a lot of sense because I can hear a lot of like classical technique and ideas.
Yeah.
You know, it's very based in technique. But yeah, it's so cool. I mean, my life as a musician and my musicianship got a whole lot better when I allowed myself to mess around and make mistakes.
It's pretty obvious how like the Bill Evans and the Ella Fitzgeralds of the world like influence your sound and your music and your feel for things.
Right.
Less obvious is, I guess, like the Taylor Swift side of things, which I guess you grew up listening to as well.
Absolutely.
But I'm wondering if that's more in the approach to yourself as an artist.
I think
more
so.
Than anything.
Yeah, I think, you know, the way that her artist trajectory, just the way that she's kind of been able to stay true to herself whilst climbing over different genres and every time she moves and changes a bit, you know, she retains her fans and gains new ones and people respect her as an artist, as a person. So they follow the music that she puts out. And I also think for Taylor, for me, it's the storytelling aspect as well. Like she had me believing in these stories when I was like 9 years old and I had never even talked to a boy before. And there's such power in that, being able to convince someone of a story because they've just told it so well and so beautifully. So yeah.
And convince someone of the dynamics of something, you know, it's like
exactly
of how it will be when you finally.
Yeah. Well, there's so many songwriters that like my music doesn't really, you know, come close to resembling, but I'm just so inspired by like their lyricism and their approach. You know, it's like, I love Carole King as well. And like the Carpenters and down to like Sarah Bareilles. Like my inspirations are kind of all over the place, but they're all like very potent songwriters.
Yeah. Have you gotten into Joni Mitchell yet?
I was going to mention Joni Mitchell as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and some of her stuff, she's done some really cool string stuff as well, like orchestral sounding stuff, which I obviously really admire.
I imagine you probably want to start doing something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Or dabbling with that. I loved, speaking of the orchestral side of things, I loved your song California and Me.
Oh, thank you.
My favorite song on the, I mean, I'm sure it'll change, but over the last week and a half or so, that's been like dialed in as my favorite.
Thank you.
So beautiful.
I love that one. Yeah, I obviously, having a classical music background, I always wanted to find ways of bringing that into a new audience of listeners who maybe have never gotten to experience listening to a symphony orchestra or the sound world that a symphony orchestra lives in. And I'm so aware of how that world is, you know, kind of unapproachable and inaccessible for a pop music audience, for a young audience, for people that didn't grow up within the world like me.
Yeah.
And I just kind of want to find a way always to bring it down to bring it down to earth a little bit and bring it to the people again. Like this the classical music, jazz music was meant for people. The fact that it's seems like something that's only for the educated
exactly. It's really highbrow.
Exactly is so disappointing to me because I understand those worlds so well. Like I went to classical conservatory and then I went to jazz conservatory. I know how those worlds are. And I've made an angled approach to not kind of end up in those worlds, like taking those worlds and bringing it to people who like don't typically listen to jazz or typically listen to classical music. Like my hope, of course, is that, you know, the people within those educated worlds are okay with what I'm doing. But at the end of the day,
but also who cares?
Who cares? You know? At the end of the day, I'm making it for the people who don't have access to that music. Yeah. So,
well, to that point, overall, what was your Berklee College of Music experience?
Berklee College of Music experience. It was good. I mean, the school invested a lot in me, and they gave me one of their presidential scholarships, so it covered everything. And so I didn't have to worry about that component of it while I was at Berklee, which I know is, you know, it's not an inexpensive school by any means. And I think having that looming over you can definitely change the experience. So I was very lucky to have kind of like a stress-free experience in that sense. So I got to kind of go in with a very clear mind. I was very privileged to get to go in with a clear mind and think just, okay, what can I do here? How can I make music and make music 24/7?
Are there as many people there as open to what music can be as you? Because my sense of things is that people can be very narrow about what jazz is defined as, and narrow about what they do.
Course.
Like, I'm an instrumentalist and this is, I want to.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember even at Berklee, like, I would make a point out of telling people I was a cello player and not a singer and not a jazz singer because, you know, the people who took jazz very seriously didn't think that jazz singing was a real thing, you know, or like that wasn't considered real jazz. And so, yeah, I definitely got in touch with that world and saw how that can be. And I had experienced a lot of that within classical music as well. And the classical educated world, I know even better than the kind of jazz educated world.
Much more time spent there, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say 98% of Berklee, like 95 to 98% of Berklee, was super open and all kinds of genres and people from all over the world and everyone kind of with a shared passion of wanting to do something within music. Of course, you know, wherever you go, there's going to be that group of people that are very focused on, you know, the purity of jazz music and the purity of the art, just as you have that in the classical world or, you know, any other discipline. I respect those musicians so much because honestly, those were the most talented musicians in school, I would say. But I never wanted to become a musician like that. I wanted to create my own world of music that was a mix of a couple of different disciplines. So I've been thinking a lot about it recently because, you know, I always want to really respect and honor the roots that I'm coming from. You know, I'm highly aware that jazz music, for example, is Black music. Yeah. You know, I know where that comes from. And I know, like, I studied the history of it at Berklee. I know where classical music comes from as well. I always want to honor my roots. Same with bossa nova music. I have a lot of bossa nova references. Yeah. That's Brazilian music. Yeah. You know, I'm not Brazilian. Yeah. I'm also not Black. So, you know, I think it's really important that I learn a lot about where these influences are coming from, what the history behind it is, and make sure I honor it in my music. So that's definitely something I've been thinking a lot about recently. I think mixing up styles of music, mixing and matching is totally fine. I think that's how music evolves. I think it's just important to know where it's coming from.
Yeah, and just like you can't ignore that jazz music is Black music from the Americas or whatever, like you can't ignore your own innate sort of history, right? Which is that you're not that. And it's like whatever new you can bring to that, I think is probably really cool. I mean, and that is how things
My hope is that people in those educated communities know that I'm not like, you know, painting over it or slandering the history. And I've done my duty learning about it, but I still think those worlds are a little bit gatekept now.
Yeah. And you could come in and follow it to a T. And there's people that do that. Like there's actually, I got turned on recently. I was reading a biography of, I want to say Errol Garner, but that's just because I've been listening to Misty.
I love
which
Errol
is on
Garner.
Your record. It's not Errol Garner. It's Hampton Haas, who is like a pianist from here in LA. In his book, he's writing about this Japanese woman whose name escapes me now. And she just played like bebop, like a motherfucker.
Oh, like, was it Hiromi?
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
She went to Berkeley.
Did she?
Yeah. Oh my God. Those Japanese musicians rip.
And they rip.
They're so talented.
And they do it to it. Like they do bebop, like
exactly.
Bebop should be done.
Exactly.
And not, I don't want to take away from that. But if that's not what you want to do and you're doing it, there's an element of you also just not being, like if that's what she wants to do, Hiromi,
exactly.
That's great. She's being true to herself.
Yeah.
But if you also in the process of wanting to participate in this music, want to bring your own history to it, and that's
right.
What feels the most comfortable, like you'd be a fraud if you didn't. You
yeah.
Know?
I'm having so much fun that, you know, that we live in a day and age where you can mix all these styles of music together and you can kind of be whoever you want to be and kind of create your own genre as
yeah,
well.
Yeah. Because you would have been penalized, I think, in the day for that because it wouldn't have been easily marketable or identifiable.
Oh, definitely. Even 2-3 years ago, I think I was just, you know, people, artists and people make fun of the internet and TikTok and Instagram and whatever.
Yeah.
But I have a hard time doing that because I think the reason I get to make the music I make today is because I had the freedom to do that
and you
on
got
the
to
internet.
Miss, yeah, you could bypass the traditional.
I bypassed the traditional by proving myself and with my fan base that I could do whatever music I want. And now I kind of gotten to the point where I think people in the industry trust me to make my own decisions about the music. But yeah, I mean, back in the day, you were either a pop singer or a jazz singer or a classical singer. It was very boxed up.
And the people who got past it, by the grace of God, like a Stevie Wonder,
exactly.
Could, whatever, but there are very few. And even Joni Mitchell is celebrated as she is.
Yes.
I would argue she's, I don't want to say underrated, but in terms of the general public's consumption and understanding of her music.
Right.
Probably because it was too confusing what it was.
It was a bit confusing,
It should be as heralded as, you know, the Beatles and all
exactly.
The other stuff, but it's not. And
yeah.
It's just crazy.
I think now being unique is actually quite celebrated. And, you know, when I was younger, all these things that made me so confused, like being a cellist or, you know, being, you know, mixed race and being loud, these things that I used to feel like were my limits are actually the things that have made me who I am and given me a career.
So cool.
Like, very, very obviously.
We have to pause for another quick break, and then we'll come back with the rest of my interview with Leve.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
We're back with the rest of my conversation with Leve.
What was the social media trajectory in terms of putting your music on? I mean, were you ever using YouTube early on, like, to put music out? Even as a kid, like, were you documenting stuff
all
that way?
Oh, of course. I posted some covers on YouTube when I was 12. Are just like everyone else. No, they aren't up, but I have them. I have them. They're private. They're quite cute. But yeah, the story starts 2020. The pandemic had just started, and I came back home and I was like, okay, I have this empty space of time now. I'd recorded one song, which ended up being the first song I ever put out. It just so happened that that was like the first semester that I was working on writing and recording.
Wow.
And that was a song called Street by Street. But anyways, I got back home, the song wasn't out yet, and I thought it was a 2-week break. I was like, you know, I'm gonna write as much as I possibly can, and I'm going to post videos of myself playing jazz standards on the internet just as a form of practice, and we'll just see what happens. Never in a million years would I have thought that what happened would happen, which was, you know, the videos got some attention on the internet. I guess there were a lot of people bored at home on their phones as well.
Right, right.
And they just started getting shared, and my following started to grow really fast.
And you were doing more. And even in those early videos, it was kind of, to be honest, like more just straight jazz.
It was like, just straight jazz, yeah.
Like covers of Louie and Ella.
Absolutely.
Or whatever. It wasn't even like your own material, at least that I've seen.
Right, yeah. There were a couple, like maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks, I'd post a song that, you know, resembled a jazz standard, which is kind of how I started writing also in that style. I didn't really realize that you could do that, that you could write like a jazz standard sounding song in 2020. So
it sounds intimidating. I'm going to write a standard.
Right. It's basically proclaiming that you want to write a song that lasts forever.
I'm going to write a classic.
Exactly. That's exactly that's the idea. But I wrote one song called Like the Movies, just like on my guitar, and it was very cutesy. Like, now I look back and I'm like, that was a very innocent song, but it was in kind of like an old style, and I posted it on TikTok. It was my first TikTok, and it kind of like went viral, and all these comments were coming in being like, oh, this sounds like something I've heard in a movie or something like my grandma loves. And I slowly started to realize that, you know, there's kind of like a space missing for Gen Z to indulge in this kind of music. So I kind of just continued doing that, writing songs in that style, posting them online, and also posting videos of myself singing and playing cello and guitar and piano to singing these jazz standards that had, you know, to me, they're old songs, but to Gen Z, someone seeing it on their TikTok, you know, for the first time, that's a new song.
Yeah.
That's a new sound.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really, really cool. And so it kind of just snowballed from there. Yeah, I became Jazz Girl on Instagram and TikTok.
Did it feel overwhelming? Did you necessarily know where to go from there?
I had one song that's Street by Street that I put out like 3 weeks into the pandemic, just like on DistroKid. I just like threw it out there and no clue what I was doing. And it just luckily somehow, I think I was growing an audience at the same time, and it just got thrown into you know, the algorithm, if you will. I don't even know if that's the right word, but it was just really good timing.
And got picked up like on Spotify.
It got picked up. Yeah, like it hit some Discover Weeklies or something cool. like that. So people started listening, and the music was like almost like a derivative of jazz in that it had a lot of jazz principles, but was, you know, a modern story and something new and didn't seem too different from what I was, you know, posting online. So it kind of, yeah, it just grew and it became almost like I kind of harnessed social media. Like I knew I'd built a community on there that was so great for me and my creative process. Like that first year of COVID, I really spent figuring out who I was as an artist. And, you know, I could turn on a live stream at the flip of a switch and sing a song that I'd written that day and get immediate feedback. And then I got to know my fans and they got to know me and they were from all over the world. And we'd talk about the state of COVID and we'd be like, oh, what's happening? And
all
like,
the fun stuff.
You know, Peru. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it was so special. And I'd have these like Sunday lullaby live streams.
Oh, wow.
So every Sunday I'd turn on a lullaby live stream and I'd just sing and we'd talk.
That's great. I wish I had found that during COVID.
It definitely saved me from a very a bleak time in history, I would say.
Yeah.
And I think that's another part of why the timing of the project worked, because I think nobody wanted to be reminded of the bleak times and the music I was offering up sounded like it was of a different time.
Yeah.
Everything was so online and getting something that felt less online, like jazz music.
Or jazz. I also went back to like some of those like old musicals. Like, yeah. Oklahoma or whatever.
I love Oklahoma.
It's very cool.
I'm a huge Rodgers and Hammerstein fan, so the songs from those films are like my favorite.
Surrey with the Fringe on top. Like, are you kidding
me? Unmatched. Chicks and Ducks and Geese, They Will Scurry.
Incredible.
That's rapping right there.
It is. And with that beautiful melody, dude. I mean, I don't
so
know.
So good.
How they came up with that stuff's incredible.
No, I know. It's wild.
Would you mind? There's a guitar right there. Would you mind sort of playing that the first song?
Sure, yeah.
Street by Street. Just a bit of it.
Yeah. So I was almost in like more of a R&B kind of swing of jazz back then, like lo-fi.
Cool.
So yeah, it's interesting how it's evolved. But anyways, Street by Street. This view used to bring a smile to my face. Lately it's done nothing but remind me of the way, the way that you used to give me butterflies. Took me 21 days to walk our former paradise. Paradise. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-da. Step by step, brick by brick, I'm reclaiming what's mine. This city is way too small to give away to just one guy. Street by street, breath by breath, from the Back Bay to the sky, I'm taking back my city. I'm taking back my life.
Your voice is so incredible. It, like live, like, hearing it in this room is insane.
Oh, thank you.
I know you got a great voice, but it was honestly in the room incredible.
Thank you very much.
That's a cool song.
Yeah, it's a cute one. It was like one of the first songs I ever wrote, and it really healed me. I remember I had my light bulb moment after writing that song. I was like, oh my God. I was like in the middle of writing it. My heart was racing. I was like, I think I have it. I think I got something.
Was there any music that particularly inspired you while writing that? Anything you were referencing in your mind or...
I don't know. There's like, you know, there was a lot of Sam Cooke that I was listening to. Cool. So it was like a Sam Cooke lick kind of that I threw in there. You know, there was jazz music. I was also listening to like a lot of Bruno Major at the time, I went to a concert with him and it was the first time I really saw jazz and like kind of songwriting being presented alongside each other. And it really inspired me. So,
yeah. Well, as you were playing that, it occurred to me that, I mean, in a way, you're a jazz singer or just a singer with some jazz influence and a player, but also like a singer-songwriter. I mean, not many people did that in jazz, I guess. You know,
no.
Nina Simone a couple of times.
Right,
you
right.
Know?
No, it's a very rare thing to be a singer and a songwriter of jazz.
In jazz, yeah.
Because historically, jazz singers sing...
Songs by people who don't sing.
And then, you know, aside from obviously like Ella and a couple of examples, like didn't improvise either. So they weren't, of course, they had their own takes on songs, but it wasn't creating in that sense. So, yeah, I wear many hats.
Well, I presume much of your songwriting is about your own experiences. Is it?
Yeah, most of them are personal stories.
Is it weird then to follow like the people like Taylor Swift down to Carole King that you mentioned and kind of putting your life out for your fans and that sort of...
I don't think too much about it.
Okay.
People ask me a lot, like, oh, aren't you embarrassed to put it out or isn't it exposing? And I think in a way, like when I bottle up an experience or an emotion in a song and let it free, it's no longer completely mine. Mm. And then it doesn't feel as daunting. That being said, the thought of someone listening to a song I wrote about them is terrifying. But I just don't think about that. I think in my delusional mind, I'm like, yeah, they're not listening.
That's the American in you, the delusional American.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, if they listen, I just hope they don't tell me unless it's like a really, really nice thing. Then maybe they can tell
me. Years from now, they can tell you. You know,
yeah, exactly.
No longer matters.
But it's also worth it when someone's like, oh, I've experienced that before. I can relate.
Yeah.
So
the album cover, too, I should say, it's very cool.
Oh, thank you.
Was it your idea?
It was me and my twin sister, who's my creative director.
Sweet.
She kind of, you know, the whole visual world behind Leve is her kind of thought creation.
Is that what she studied in college?
No. She studied international relations and music. She's a smart cookie. But the idea kind of came from the music itself on this album is more mature. And
than your last record.
Than my last record, yeah. And I kind of wanted to shock my audience a little bit. I think my first album was so innocent that I wanted this second one to be a little bit more like otherworldly.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very kind of like glossy, silvery. I almost wanted to appear more otherworldly somehow.
It is. And it's a striking cover.
Thank you.
It's really striking.
Thank you.
Is there anything you want to try in the future in terms of like you've had some strings on this, you know,
yeah.
You've worked with an orchestra.
Oh yeah, I
definitely
want to do
try.
More orchestra stuff. I want to write film music. I really want to write something for film.
I would love to hear you do a soundtrack.
There's
a couple of songs on here that I feel like could be theme for a movie.
I definitely, every song to me is like a little movie, like every story from start to finish. And then the way that it's painted musically is very... I like to think everyone is like a little movie. But yeah, I'd love to do more orchestra stuff as well. On the other side of things, I'd love to like just like show up with like a random folk album or like country album, like lean really into the storytelling. And then, of course, like I want to do like some like a standards album at some point.
Cool.
And something more, you know, straightforward jazz in that sense. But I think for now, my work isn't completely done in doing it the way that I am right now.
Would you ever get a group, like a band together?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that you kind of just do all like tour with and make records with and...
Sure, yeah. I have a band that I tour with right now who are really great. And the records so far have just been made, besides an orchestra and a couple of musicians here and there, it's been mostly just me and my producer, Spencer, playing all the instruments. And I'm having quite a lot of fun doing that.
That's cool. How did you meet Spencer?
I was just doing my session rounds and, you know, going to different producers and kind of hoping and praying that I'd find somebody who understood my vision and understood the jazz part and the classical part and the pop part and like the songwriting part. And I happened upon Spencer and he just immediately understood it. I remember I was so worried that it would be hard to find, and it was quite hard to find. But when I found Spencer, I was like, oh my God, like this is it. Like I found my musical soulmate.
So. That's great. Well, hey, thank you so much for
thank you.
Making the drive up.
And of course.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Leve for singing some of her gorgeous songs for us. You can hear a collection of all of our favorite Leve songs on a playlist at brokenrecordpodcast.com. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/brokenrecordpodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose and Eric Sandler. Our show is engineered by Echo Mountain. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like this show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com. Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.